28th of April, 1996, in the sleepy little tourist town of Port Arthur in the state of Tasmania, a young man by the name of Martin Bryant carried out Australia's deadliest mass shooting, in which 35 people were killed and 23 were wounded. Martin Bryant, a man with subnormal IQ and intellectual disabilities, pleaded guilty for the incident and was given 35 life sentences without possibility of parole, or so the official story tells it. The wake of the shooting brought fundamental and sweeping changes to the gun control laws of Australia. The case is regarded to be amongst the most notable massacres in Australia's history. But was Port Arthur our 9/11? A false flag perpetrated on the Australian public with the full support of the Australian media and law enforcement agencies? Was Martin Bryant the sole person responsible for the massacre? Or was he even in fact present at the shooting? Was there foreknowledge of the shooting? Were notable preparations put in place ahead of time so that a distinct narrative would play out? If so, who are the likely perpetrators and traitors to our country? To take us through this rabbit, Warren is a guest on tonight's show. He is the producer of a feature film to be released soon titled WASP, The Port Arthur Massacre. Paul Moder, thanks for joining us on the General Knowledge Podcast. How are you going?
Hi, how are you guys? Good evening.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us, mate. So, we've finally got you on the show. We've tried a little bit over the week, but stuff happens. But you're here now, and we've got to pick your brain on Port Arthur. And I'm sure you're going to blow the tops on a few of our listeners, and even Ethan and I. Ethan, how are you going? You're on standby there, big fella?
Yeah, good, mate. Good to be here. I'm looking forward to this episode.
Yeah,
very,
me too.
Good topic to be explaining about.
Absolutely, mate. Yeah, for sure. Well, Paul, we might just delve straight away and just tell the folks who are listening who is Paul Moder, what you're about, what you're doing, and what's the mission here, mate?
I've been a filmmaker from the early days. I used to make films before there were such things as HD video cameras. We used to make Super 8 films.
Oh, yeah.
So I grew up in an era, where there was no internet, no mobile phones, and we used to make Super 8 movies. We ended up making over 100 of those things, and they took me to film school, so I got my degree in film and TV. And then I've worked, I won't say in the industry, sort of on the fringes of the industry, really. I'm a bit of a maverick. And I've done everything from producing, writing, acting, and I'm also a licensed pyrotechnician, so I blow things up as well.
Nice.
So I've worked in the industry for something like 25 years now.
Awesome. Oh, it seems like you've got all the credentials there in place to put together a production like WASP. What can I actually just find out, first of all, I'm not sure, why is it called WASP?
WASP is a title that I chose to suggest the ambiguity of the event. There is some factually recorded information about WASPs. So to give you some idea, when the shooter was going down to Port Arthur, he stopped by the side of the road to help two girls who'd broken down in their car. And he was able to fix their car and get it started, which is kind of unusual because Martin Bryant was said to have an IQ of 66 and not very conversant with working with machinery. But somehow he got this girl's car started, and he bought a bag of marijuana off them for $50. So they had a bit of a conversation. It was a bit flirtatious, apparently. And they saw the surfboard on his car and said, "Are you going surfing?" And he said, "No, I'm going down to the Isle of the Dead to get rid of some wasps."
Wow.
And they sort of looked at him askance, and he said, "Oh, you can join me down there in the cafe and buy me a coffee." And then he drove off. When the shooter was in the cafe, he went outside, ordered a meal, went outside on the balcony and started waving his hands around erratically and loudly proclaimed, "A lot of wasps around today, not too many Jap tourists." And then later on, he was interviewed by the police, and they said, "Were you aware of European wasps at Broad Arrow Cafe?" And he said, "No." And they said, "Do you have any other understanding of the term WASP, meaning white Anglo-Saxon Protestants?" And he said, "No, but I'm allergic to bee stings. I almost died when I was a kid." However, there were witnesses that stated that there were European wasps at the cafe. So WASPs, to me, suggests an ambiguity with motive. If the shooter was deliberately targeting white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, it gives him a slightly more astute understanding of socioeconomics. However, he could have been referring to wasps. And a wasp, unlike a bee, can sting again and again and again. So that's why I chose the title. It's the ambiguity of the event, but wasps do tend to come up in the case on various occasions.
Well, I wasn't aware of that. Actually, I'm just noticing there's a bit of a beep in the background there, Paul. Is that, can that be audibly turned down at all?
Is that unfortunately not. It's sort of a command center at the moment, believe it or not.
Oh, okay. Roger that.
Dramatic thing in the background.
No,
so
that's all right. We'll work with it. Don't worry about it. Well, that's amazing. I had no idea that that's what it was actually an anagram for. Not an anagram. I can't think of the word now. What's it called, Ethan? When you have letters.
don't throw to me, mate.
Yeah, but anyway, I had no idea that it was. That's what it referred to. Go on.
Furthermore, that when we talk about motive and when we talk about the alleged intelligence and pre-planning of the perpetrator, there was strong indications that the ferry which transferred tourists to the Isle of the Dead in Tasmania, which is a little island which has gravestones on it and it's a little historic site, was the initial target. And on the day, that ferry had 80 US citizens on it. So if you can imagine, if a gunman gets onto a ferry and nobody can get off, and there are 80 elderly US citizens, as well as Australian citizens and international tourists, then they'd literally have nowhere to go. It'd be literally like shooting fish in a barrel.
Yep.
And if they're all on the island as well, it's the same thing. There'd be nowhere to go. It's a little tiny island in the middle of the bay. So if that target had been the initial choice and had been successfully attacked, then there may have been some greater international repercussions, given that it would have been US citizens killed. However, on the day, the ferry was half an hour late. So apparently, when Martin Bryan, I'm just going to say, just call him by his name, when Martin Bryan arrived, supposedly he had an argument about where to park. He tried to park down near the jetty, and was told he couldn't park there by Ian Kingston, who was like the security manager. Mm-hmm. And he got upset, and then Ian told him that the ferry was going to be late by half an hour. And then Martin Bryan supposedly got upset and drove off. And then when Ian looked back, he'd parked there again, but he'd walked in towards the gift shop and the cafe, and that's where the actual shooting took place. So a lot of the conspiracy people are saying that that was the original target, and there are indications mm-hmm. that it was the case, mm-hmm. but because it was late, he chose a secondary target, which was a Broad Arrow Cafe.
Yeah, right. Ethan, did you want to have a question at all there?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. When we interviewed Wendy Skerr in 2015, she was actually referring to that as well. She was talking about how the timetables actually had changed during that day, during the season that it was. They've actually reduced them from every half an hour to every hour, and she believes that that absolutely was the target, you know. So I've heard that quite a bit, and I do believe that if you actually think about it, and as Paul was noting to there, you know, if that was the target, what greater international implications could that have had? You know, it could have expanded a lot greater than it did. And, you know, it just seems a bit odd that they just went into the cafe, you know, with all of the hills and everything around it. It seemed like a bit of an odd setting. It seemed like perhaps they might have had another target to begin with. So it's great. I love it. I completely agree, mate.
Was in Australia at the time. He wasn't in Tasmania, but Bill Clinton was in Australia. And there are some of the litany of anomalies and weird coincidences and strange events that are factually based occurred where when the shooter went into the cafe and started shooting, a fellow called Tony Kiston got to his feet and yelled out, "No, no, not here," and then was shot down.
Who was that guy? Do we know who he was?
Accordingly, it just seems to be one of the many tourists that were in the cafe. The conspiracy people are asking questions about some of the identity of the people that were killed in the cafe. They were suggesting that they may have been plants, ASIO plants or operatives who were placed in the cafe in order to witness what would take place on the ferry. However, when the plan went awry, suddenly they became victims, which would then explain why Tony got to his feet and went, no, not here.
Yeah, wow, that's incredible.
You're not supposed to do it here. Now, I'm not going to suggest that I believe that 100%. To me, that's hearsay. I don't know how deeply people have dug into the backgrounds of some of the victims that were shot. They ostensibly had normal jobs and were there as tourists on holiday. So whether
were they
or not
Americans at all? Do you know if they were from the US?
No, most of the people in the cafe, there were definitely international people there, you know, tourists there, and people of different nationalities, Indian, Asian, American, I'm not sure about in the cafe. But there were quite a few interesting people at Port Arthur on the day. I believe there was the head of the African National Congress was there, and I also believe there was a Canadian government official and his wife. So it would be interesting to get a manifest of whoever it was that were going to be taking the ferry that day. There may have been some
interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Especially if they were US nationals.
Yeah, that would be interesting to delve into that.
I've had it put to me that it's a possibility that perhaps the whole thing was a cover for an attempt to assassinate somebody of import. But once again, that's all hearsay. I want to be very clear on this, that I have a scientific mind. So I've read everything there is, and I'm certainly open to things, but I'm very much about hard facts, hard evidence.
Yeah, and you need to be. That's understandable.
You know, I've seen a lot of people, like I've read Joe Vialis's work, and in my opinion, he takes way too many leaps of conjecture. You know, you can't sort of say, oh, there's a black van that was parked there, therefore it's Mossad. You can't say those sort of things. It's a black van. Yes, it's unusual. It's strange. That, by the way, there was an unmarked black van that was parked out the front of the Broad Arrow Cafe after the massacre, and it was photographed. But
no
as
tags.
To who owned it, why it was there, it had tags. It had number plates on it, but who owned it and why it was there is another question. So it's very important, and I can't stress this enough, we do ourselves a disservice if we basically just make these enormous leaps and accusations and without trying to found them in hard fact. And that's why it's very easy for people to turn around and dispel any alternate theories as being conspiracy nuts. Because some people just go way out on a limb without trying to back up what they're saying.
Yeah, and that's fair enough. It's definitely hard to come up with proof of anything in all of these events that take place, and you know, which we refer to as false flags around the world. You know, there is proof. It's hard to find the proof, but it gets to the point where you're constantly asking questions and you're not getting the answers, but at least you're asking those questions. I think that's probably one of the most important things, because you're then encouraging the audience and the people watching and the general public at large to think more. You're encouraging them to think, because they're not thinking for themselves. They're constantly told this was the official narrative of whatever the event is. This is what happened. You know, it's what the media comes and tells us. And I believe they play a very strong part in making sure that, you know, stuff like your work doesn't get out there, because they're the controllers of the official narrative, you know what I mean? So for blokes like you who are making a feature film and perhaps some documentaries, which we talked about pre-show here in the room we were recording before, but it's very important to ask as many questions as possible. Even though you may not have the answers for them, I think it's very important that you do find all the little bits and pieces that may have happened on the day and ask questions about that, because someone may have an answer somewhere. You know what I mean?
I fully agree. I've always said there's nothing wrong with asking questions. I mean, Stephen Hawking has a theory. You know, Carl Sagan has a theory, and interestingly enough, if you want to check the facts on it, the people that created the term conspiracy theorist to dispel notions of alternate theories and questioning events were the CIA.
Yeah, that came through in the Warren Commission, didn't it?
Yeah, so the CIA created the term conspiracy theorist specifically to basically dissuade people from questioning the official story. So there's nothing wrong with asking questions, but anyone who's out there, I've read all the stuff there is on factual record and also a lot of the hearsay stuff. All I'll say is hard evidence, new and compelling evidence. It's got to be hard facts as much as you can. But obviously with false flags, it would behoove them to create as much confusion, misinformation, and disinformation as possible so that you can't differentiate the truth from the hoax, from the deliberate disinformation that's placed out there. And that's how it works. That's why you can never find the truth, because it's deliberately obfuscated.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you maybe take us through, Paul, some of the what you might call, there could be more than a top five, but let's say a top five of the biggest questions that you have with regards to this event. Obviously, we're asking questions. It's okay to ask questions. Well, what are some of the biggest questions that you have with regards to this event that would, lead people elsewhere away from the official narrative?
Well, the biggest question for me was that this was at the time the biggest mass shooting by a lone gunman in world history. And I can't stress that enough.
Right.
And by law, and I mean state law, it must mandate a coronial inquest. If you have more than one or two people who die violently or die by fire or foreign nationals die on your soil, you must have a coronial inquest. This was an enormous event, and Howard squashed the coronial inquest. So one of my first questions is why? Why do we not have a coronial inquest to basically open all this up? The flippant reason given was we don't want to drag everyone through all the trial and the horror of the event. And it was certainly, I can understand the emotional need for that, but that does not in any way dispel the absolute crucial need for a case of this magnitude to warrant a coronial inquest. And following on the heels of that, there was also no open trial. So The legal beagles, including our old friend of the media, who I like to call one of the legion of bleached teeth infomercial salesmen masquerading as journalists, Waleed Ali, who I had a stoush with on the project, was basically saying, "Oh, we don't need to have an open trial because he pled guilty." Now, technically, by the letter of the law, absolutely. However, the victims themselves, many of the victims, including Wendy and Stephen Howard, were calling for a coronial inquest to answer questions about the OCC health and safety issue of the locked fire door. That alone necessitated a coronial inquest because seven people lost their lives because they couldn't get out of a fire door in a government building. So the victims were furious. They were like, why was the fire door locked? But that didn't happen. Therefore, there was no open trial to be able to even discuss that aspect of the case. It was once again repressed. So no open trial means that any forensic evidence that was gathered, and I spoke to one of the female New South Wales forensics team who, quote, crawled all over that cafe. And initially she was very helpful. And all I wanted to do was get a confirmation from her. Did you take fingerprints from the tray, his drink cup, his utensils, the bag? Did you take DNA samples, And she said, I'll just have to talk to my supervisor, came back to me, and then the hammer came down. And she said, no, look, I can't talk about it. Everything's been handed over to Taspol, and that's it. So I can't even get a confirmation of whether or not DNA prints were taken. And I assume they were. If a forensics team crawls all over the cafe, they're going to get the evidence. But it has never seen the light of day in a court of law. Neither has a video that supposedly was taken. And actually, I'll back it. I'm not going to say supposedly. There was a leaked tape that was discovered in a tip. It was a police training video, which was quite horrendous, which had basically the police had done a training video and they'd filmed a lot of the victims and the aftermath of the shooting and also had discussions with the various officers involved. During the course of that video, which you can get online, it's under Live Leak, the camera pans around the cafe. You see the table where Martin Bryan supposedly sat. You see his tray, his can of drink, his utensils. You see the blue bag from which allegedly the firearms were taken. And you see a video camera that was set up next to the table, presumably used to record. Witnesses state that the person came into the cafe was carrying a grey video camera bag. So, presumably, this camera was set up to record the shooting and would positively identify the shooter. That tape has never seen the light of day. And that's my third question. Why? Because all you'd have to do is show that tape and say, look, there he is. There's Martin Bryant. We can see him clear as day. He recorded himself doing the shooting. Why has that not been ever presented as evidence?
I reckon it's just been turned to ash now, mate. they would have burnt that tape long ago, surely.
I did speak to someone, it's hearsay, but they said that a New South Wales police officer showed them the tape and that that tape is now locked up in a drawer somewhere in Canberra and will never see the light of day. Mm. So that's one of my questions. The other one, of course, is the firearms.
Tell us about the firearms. I know there's a lot of your conjecture about, you know, did he use this gun? Was he using this gun? Did he do headshot? Like all this sort of stuff. So, yeah, tell us about this firearm business.
Okay, I've dug very, very deeply to try and track the firearms. One thing that the public don't know, which they should know, all of our firearms laws stem pretty much from Port Arthur. Mm. So after Port Arthur, John Howard enacted some of the most stringent firearm laws in the world. What they don't know is that there was a farmer by the name of Bill Drysdale from Yay, Victoria, who was watching all the Port Arthur footage. And when Gerard Dutton held up the AR-15, he said, that's my gun. I handed that in 1987 in Victoria under John Kane's laws, and I was told that the gun would be destroyed at Sims Metal. The Herald Sun commenced an investigation into the firearms that were used, and they discovered that that 17 assault rifles, if you want to call them that, we call them high-powered semi-automatic rifles, including the one that was handed in by Bill Drysdale, were not destroyed. They were kept by the Victorian SOGs, Special Operations Group Police, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and used as their own personal firearms. They were then re-registered and given new serial numbers under the Victorian Licensing Regulation Division, which is illegal. And then they were sold to a gun dealer I know called Garnet Featherstone at Granite Arms for $134,000. So whoever Garnet onsold those weapons to, one of them ended up in Tasmania. So the bottom line is that the people responsible for putting the AR-15 back on the street were the police. I also have it on fairly good authority from a gun dealer in Tasmania that when firearms were handed in other states of Australia, under their restrictive laws, they went one way into the police station, they went out the back door straight down to Tasmania, and they were then sold because Tasmania had very lax gun laws. So I guess the whole point of demonising law-abiding firearm owners kind of gets lost a little bit when you think about, well, there was a bit of corruption involved in getting those firearms back on the street into the hands of whoever it was that committed that atrocity. So not many people know about that, but it's there. So that's another little factor.
Do you have one more?
Interesting firearms. Gerard Dutton, who was the ballistic expert, supposedly, though I've had other police officers and friends of his, very good friends of him, tell me that he hasn't exactly come clean about the ballistics for Port Arthur.
Ooh, okay.
I've had a I spoke to a Tasmanian firearms ballistic officer who worked with Gerard, who basically said, I've seen the report, the ballistics report on Port Arthur, and I would classify it as the non-ballistics report. So the bottom line is that the firearms were so catastrophically destroyed that you could not supposedly gain any evidence of their use in the – you couldn't basically match the ballistics up. And Gerard Dutton was fronted by a journalist during a convention when he was talking about this, and the journalist basically asked the question, said, is there any evidence linking the firearms to Martin Bryant or to the crime scene? There was a this journalist was pushed out of the convention by some police. There was a, you know, the thing was shut down momentarily, and then it recommenced.
Just protecting their own.
Basically went on record and said, no, there is, it was asked the question again and said, there is no empirical evidence linking the firearms to the crime scenes. So that doesn't mean they weren't used, and it doesn't mean that they weren't owned by Martin Bryant. But the problem is that in a court of law, it's got to be beyond reasonable doubt. So if you have a crime scene where you have, you know, very little hard evidence presented, then a good defense lawyer would say, well, hang on, there's no evidence linking these firearms to Martin Bryant or to the crime scene. So how can we establish that as a fact? I don't doubt that there were ballistics taken. I don't doubt that if the police have as much forensics evidence as they claim to have, well, then they know something that nobody else does, because it's never seen a court of law.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So firearms, interestingly enough, when you see or read Brian interviewed by the police, and this is some 5 months after he was kept in solitary confinement, and he talks about the firearms. They show him the firearms. He categorically recognizes and acknowledges the ownership of the AR-15, the 223 semi-automatic. Mm-hmm. He also acknowledges ownership of the Daewoo semi-automatic shotgun. When they show him the FN rifle, the FN SLR 308, everyone knows it as an SLR, he says, no, I've never seen that gun before. So you go, well, why would he admit to a couple of the guns but not admit to others? So it's kind of odd. The FN was also used in the massacre, and it was discovered on the roof of the cottage where the siege had taken place, with a bent barrel and a missing carrier spring. And when I say a carrier spring, I don't mean a little spring. This thing was about a good 6 inches long. It's a solid spring that basically returns the bolt to the breech and loads ammunition. That spring is vanished and was not present when that firearm was recovered. So was it used or wasn't it?
And the barrel was bent, you said?
That's only the small part of it. The FN barrel was bent. I'm a shooter. I've been a shooter for many years, and I'm also a reloader. When they recovered the AR-15, they said that a shell had somehow exploded so catastrophically in the breech that it melted the brass casing into the bolt face of the gun, and therefore prevented any kind of ballistics measurements to be taken from that AR-15. Now, I know enough about reloading. If you overload a shell, it will blow up in the gun and could shatter the gun, absolutely. In fact, it will most likely blow the gun apart. But it didn't do that. So the gun itself was pretty much, when it was recovered, it was missing a pistol grip. But the whole breech from the surface, that the gun still looked fairly whole. And if it had exploded that dangerously in somebody's hands, then that would have caused a lot of injury. So that certainly would have been evident on Martin Bryant, because if he'd fired a gun and it had blown up in his face, it would have taken fingers off and all sorts of things. However, the only thing they can say is that the shell had just exploded in the breech somehow and melted so badly that they couldn't do ballistics comparisons. Yeah, so it's kind of odd.
It is. That's very
the military uses a technique called hot shots, where if they have to abandon artillery, they'll load shells with C4 and then the enemy grabs the thing and fires it and blows himself to pieces.
Yeah, right.
the frustrating thing, of course, is that the firearms, at least from a public point of view, there doesn't seem to be very much hard evidence linking those firearms to the crime scenes, or all of them, to ownership by Martin Bryant. Martin didn't have a license, a firearms license. However, Terry Hill, who was the gun dealer accused of selling him the firearms, basically went on record to say that somebody came in and showed him a license under the name Martin Ryan, and he said it was one of the new plastic laminated licenses authorizing the owner to have fully and semi and fully automatic weapons, which are machine guns.
Yep.
So that's what he says. Whether there were deals done under the counter, you know, somebody flashing a lot of money around because Martin had a lot of money. Once again, hearsay. The gun registers for both Terry Hill, Garnet Featherstone, who I mentioned before, have been seized by police, and they've never seen the light of day or a court of law either.
Yeah. Ethan, do you have a question you want to ask Paul?
Yeah, mate, I'll jump in if I can. This is fantastic. I love it. We're straight into the deep end here. Just to add some context, I know we've got some international listeners who might not be familiar with the event. Obviously, General touched on it at the beginning. But there's been a lot of parallels between this in Australia and some of the effects that 9/11 had on the United States in some circles. And this was really, you know, in the pre-era before all of this false flag sort of era began after 9/11, you know, 96, it was sort of in the forefather sort of era there with these events that were happening. So it was very important here in Australia, and it ended up, as Paul has touched on, with the introduction of gun laws and the supposed gun confiscation of Australia. It's a big misconception overseas, but a lot less guns were handed over than most people do believe here in Australia. And this event was something that obviously not only implemented a lot of legal changes here in Australia and a lot of precedents that would lead to some of these anti-terror laws and this terrorism hysteria later on, but it also engineered the public's perception of things like guns, things like self-protection, and was really a massive experiment that happened in this country. So for those out there who are not familiar with the event, just go and look up some of those points that Paul was just touching on then, you know, and that's what I love just hearing from Paul. You know, there's a lot of, you know, charlatans and clowns in any type of scene, regardless of where it is. And as he said, you know, you've got a large majority of people that discredit this type of information by talking about, you know, the black van, it's confirmed Mossad, you know. So it's just refreshing to see Paul focus on the facts, focus on the actual story and what has happened here and some of the inconsistencies with it. And I wanted to touch on that, Paul, just to get your sort of expansion on that, mate. You were talking about how you've met all of these, you know, these forensic teams and these police officers. Is this to do with the film that you're creating, mate? Is this going to be in conjunction with the film that you're creating? And can you expand a little bit more on what you're trying to do with WASP in relation to all these inconsistencies that you've started to find with Port Arthur, mate?
I just wanted to say that I've got a great deal of respect for the police and the first responders. Yep. It's very, very important to me that this film be respectful to the police, the first responders, the victims and families. And my intention was to talk to these people to get their, not only their viewpoint on everything, but also how they felt, how it affected them, because that's certainly going to be portrayed in the film. So I dug deeper than most people. I spoke to a lot of the police that were directly involved. I spoke to the fellow who negotiated with Martin in the cottage, who was calling himself Jamie when the siege was occurring. I spoke to the police officer who guarded him in hospital after he was burnt out of the fire and taken to hospital. Spoken to a lot of the police that were directly involved, were there on the day. A lot of the first responders, the people that the ambulance drivers, the people that treated Martin, certainly people that grew up with him, people who had spent time with him in prison. And the whole intent was that to get as much information as I can straight from the horse's mouth. That was, for want of a better term, at least first person accurate. And I found that the police officers in the police, for the most part, were very supportive of the film. Understandably, they were a bit tired of having to talk about Port Arthur all the time. They basically poo-pooed the notion that it was anything other than Martin Bryant, which I can understand. But I certainly braced them with some of the hard questions. They were pretty forthcoming. But I guess I didn't expect anything more from the police in that regards. I very much doubt that they would ever come forward and say, well, guess what? You know. Mm-hmm. However, I will actually temper that a little bit, because I was speaking to or I was in contact with a fellow who was an ex-Australian Federal Police officer and an ex-ADF, which is Australian Defence Force member. I won't name that person. And I sort of said, oh, you would have some interesting sort of viewpoints on Port Arthur. And he said, all I'll say is watch your back, mate. You could be waking a sleeping giant. And I just sort of went on with the conversation and didn't sort of push anything or didn't lead it in any way. And then he just straight out basically communicated and said, you should know that Port Arthur was not a TASPOL operation. It was a SACPAV operation run out of Canberra with the ADF. It's the Standing Advisory Committee on the Prevention Against Violence, basically counter-terrorism exercises.
Okay.
So it's called SACPAV. So this guy just came straight out and just said that, and I was a bit stunned into silence, and I thought, well, you know, it's just what he's saying. Does that mean that it's truthful or not? However, I do know that the Special Operations Group, the SAS, and the ADF were conducting SACPAV operations on the Tasman Peninsula in the months leading up to Port Arthur. Now, that's not unusual per se, because they do SACPAV exercises all over Australia, but it is coincidental.
They did them in Sydney prior to the Link Cafe, didn't they, Ethan?
Yes, I do believe so. They were doing counter-terrorism operations there, as is always the case, General.
Yeah.
Norway, 9/11, everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, I just had to preface that one there, Paul.
Yeah, that's fine. One of the police officers I spoke to, who has been directly accused of being one of the shooters in the cottage, which took place after the cafe, where there was a siege.
If you wouldn't mind expanding on that too, after what you're saying now too, because just to fill everyone else in afterwards too.
Yeah, there was a police officer called Charles Michael Rick Dyson, who was head of the SOG at the time, Special Operations Group in Tasmania, and was also involved in the SACPAV exercises that were taking place. When Martin was in the cottage, he referred to himself as Jamie, and he kept referring to a fellow called Rick, who he said he knew Rick very well. He'd gone shooting with Rick, and he knew Rick's wife. So he was talking about somebody in the cottage with him called Rick. Everybody leapt to the fore and said, it's Charles Michael Rick Dyson, the SOG leader. I spoke to him. He was very adamant that he, you know, of course, wasn't involved, and that he wasn't there on the day. He was guarding 30 Clare Street, which was Martin's house at the time. He was assigned to guard that house, but somehow or other he was distracted and some journalists got in there and managed to steal some photographs of Martin and have a look around the house. But he swears blind that he's been accused of being one of the shooters, like literally being one of the true shooters. And I said to him, why didn't you sue? And he said, I did, but the people that are accusing me, they don't have any money, so it cost me money. But apparently he's writing a book on cyberbullying, and he swears blind that he's being victimized and targeted. And I did caution people. I said, you can go there and say, oh, he's the killer, he's the shooter. You're literally committing slander and libel and can be sued. So once again, unless you got the facts, be careful what you say, because, you know, Charles, as far as I know, went overseas for a while. He was working as an international police officer, and I believe he's back in Australia. But who knows?
Yeah. So if you could just elaborate more on the cottage shooting, because a lot of people don't know of that. And I think that was, I was like coming to party with that information as well. As far as I was aware, Port Arthur was at that cafe and that was it. But what happened in the aftermath, if you could elaborate on that a bit for us too?
Okay, well, this directly impacts the fact that the perpetrator, the alleged perpetrator, Martin Bryant, I'll say convicted perpetrator because he's been convicted, had an IQ of 66. I've read all the psych reports on Martin Bryant that there is. Basically, he's considered to be a dullard and a simpleton, and an IQ of 66 makes him an 11-year-old, effectively. However, this was a fairly comprehensively orchestrated criminal act that took place at about 8 different sites. So this 11-year-old intellectually disabled man was able to somehow decoy the only two police officers, Constables Paul Hyland and Gary Whittle, who were close to Port Arthur. They got a call saying there was some heroin stashed up in a mine, the saltwater mines on the other side of the island. So they drove off to try and find these heroin stash, and they found jars of soap powder. While they were over there, the shooting took place in Port Arthur in the main site, which was the cafe where the ferry was. So Port Arthur, for those who don't know, is the historical penal colony and tourist attraction site where all the tourists go to see all the old ruins. And that's where the initial shooting took place, in the cafe. And 20 people died in the cafe alone, and then other victims were shot at different locations. So the shooter left the cafe, he shot people in the parking lot where the buses were parked. He then went down to the toll booth, which was the entry point to Port Arthur, shot some people there, and then he went on and he'd supposedly prepared a cottage, like a bed and breakfast cottage called Seascape, by murdering the two owners in the cottage and then stocking the place full of guns and then basically undertaking a siege into the following day. So the shooting took place in Port Arthur, went out on the road, went to the toll booth, and then ended up at the Seascape Cottage, which was eventually burnt to the ground, and where Martin Bryant was arrested.
So was it sort of, you reckon it was burnt to the ground to cover up any evidence, or did they get any evidence from there? Do we know?
What the authorities say is that Martin set fire to the cottage. However, there is evidence that a SOG officer by the name of Andrew Fogarty fired phosphorus grenades, incendiary grenades, one of which disabled the BMW car which had been driven to the cottage, and the second which set the cottage on fire. However, he later on basically said that he'd fired two illuminating flares. So as to who set the cottage on fire, once again, we don't know. In the ruins, they discovered the murdered owners of the cottage, Sally and David Martin, who were elderly, and the body of Glenn Pierce, who was a hostage that was kidnapped and taken back to Seascape and murdered. So all of them were murdered, shot and all bludgeoned and stabbed, and then burnt to death in the fire. Martin ran out of the cottage on fire the following morning and was arrested by the SOGs.
I did hear, and I don't know if this is true, that he was almost, he wasn't conscious in the cottage. He was woken by the flames and fled. Was that true? Have you heard that?
I've read the SOG report where they talked about Port Arthur. Now, some interesting things happened with that siege in the cottage. The first thing was that both Constables Paul Hyland and Gary Whittle, on arriving at the cottage, both of them went on witness statements to say they saw a naked female running screaming between the buildings, a dark-haired female. That person has never been identified. You could say presumably it was the female owner of the cottage. However, she was elderly. What she would be doing running around naked and screaming between the buildings. I don't know. That scene's going in the film because it was both witnessed by the two cops. The second report was that there were multiple shooters at the cottage initially. And the police were given very, very firm instructions not to engage. At some point, the SOGs, I think it was codename Sierra, said, "I have the target in my sights. I can engage," and was told, "Do not engage." A report came out over the radio from the head of command that once again said, "Do not engage. This has to happen." Apparently, two Australian Federal Police officers were quite disgusted by that and resigned pretty much after that. Wow. But basically, police held back and they did not engage the shooter. Eventually, the cottage caught fire and Martin ran out on fire. His back was on fire. He ran into the bushes, stripped off naked, came out, and was then surrounded and held to the ground by police. The SOG's quote said he was out with the fairies, grinning and just out with the fairies, which seems to suggest that, the you know, once again, the conspiracy angle is that he may have been drugged.
Drugged, yeah, that's what comes to mind when you said that.
And if you can imagine you're lying there on your front on a bed and you're out and the place is set on fire and then you catch on fire, your back will be on fire and then you wake up and you run out and you're arrested and then you're so that the conspiracy people say there were more than one shooter in the cottage, and there is some evidence to that, and that basically at some point Martin may have been drugged, thrown on a bed, and then they were going to burn the place to the ground, but he woke up and ran out on fire. If he ran into the flames, you'd imagine the front of him would be burnt, but his back was burnt and his hair. So he was arrested and was taken to the hospital. And there was, on the ambulance, there is a witness statement by one of the ambulance officers who was talking to Martin. And Martin said, "What's the point of all this? What are you doing?" And he said, "We preserve life." And he said, "Where's Petra?" And they said, "Who's Petra?" He said, "My girlfriend." And they said, was she with you? And he said, "Yeah, in the cottage, in the fire." And he said, "Yeah, we're never apart." Petra Wilmot was Martin's girlfriend that he'd met and fell in love with 3 months before the shooting. He, in that statement, basically said that Petra was with him in the cottage. A lot of the people say that Petra was a handler, that she was put there to basically have a sort of a sympathetic and sexual, how would you say it, manipulative person to help him on his task. I don't want to condemn Petra. Petra's a mysterious person. She's kind of disappeared, understandably. But she came into his life 3 months before the massacre, a very intelligent young woman, apparently. And yeah, has not been, I can't track her down.
Seems odd that she would be with Martin Bryant to me. But anyway, can I just take us back to the cafe for a moment? Because there's something else I wanted to clarify. This is one thing I definitely heard from multiple people say when they were talking about the Port Arthur massacre and how they believe it wasn't Martin Bryant and it was not a staged event, but it was definitely not him that doing the shooting. And one of the reasons they say that is because of all the headshots that took place from a person who was apparently shooting from the hip and was very lucky in getting headshot after headshot after headshot. Is there any truth to that? Can you elaborate on that? What's your take on that?
That's one of the things I actually debunked, the so-called satanic accuracy of the shooter, that, oh, no, you know, only the top SOG guys could conduct that kind of kill ratio, which was 66 to 1. You know, all, you know, mainly headshots. As uncomfortable and distressing as it sounds, I could do what was done with that firearm. I know the AR-15 very well. We used to own one. And I basically went through it point by point, scientifically, and from a ballistics point of view, the maneuverability and ease of operation of that rifle, its lethality at close range, And the fact that, in essence, 20 victims were killed in the cafe, most of them were literally sitting ducks.
Yeah.
They either were crouched under tables, or they didn't know what was going on, or seven of them were killed trying to get out through a door that was locked. So it was, and that's why the kill count was so ratio. So the kill ratio was so high. Certainly, there was luck involved, but that firearm has very minimal recoil. It's got an ambidextrous bolt on the back. It's the perfect sort of close quarter weapon to do that kind of damage. So I don't think that it you necessarily have to be a high level SAS operative to be able to do that. Mm. However,
was Martin Bryant a shooter himself? Like, did he go?
Yes, he was.
He was, okay. So he was familiar with firearms, though. Yeah.
Was his dad brought him his first air rifle when he was 14.
Right.
Apparently, he was pretty good with it. He used to go out and he used to shoot birds and, you know, shoot apples, as most of us did when we had air rifles back in the day. So there were guns around. Now, in his interview, he said, oh, you know, I fired the AR-15 a few times and I did this. And people went, oh, see, he's not trained. It doesn't mean that he didn't go out and shoot more than he said. I mean, he owned properties that he inherited from Helen Harvey, and all the time his neighbours say they were always hearing shots. So he was a shooter.
Okay.
As to whether or not he was super accurate, I can't judge for that. As to whether or not he was trained, the only things I'll say in relation to that are that Martin Bryant inherited a lot of money and took a lot of trips overseas, and one of them was to Hereford in the UK, a very sensitive spot, Hereford.
Yeah, it's SAS, the home of, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's also, there's a lot of counterintelligence groups there. Mm. Whatever he did over there raised some kind of red flag, because Interpol rang the Australian government and said, who's this Martin Bryant guy? And he's paying cash for a hotel and he's hanging around and what's going on? So he caused some kind of disruption over there in Hereford, which is the home of the SAS. Now, the other weirdest thing, a little anomaly, which is going in a film, it's just an odd thing, is that Judy Tierney, who was a reporter, when they another investigator, when they went into Martin Bryant's house, the entire house was filthy, full of junk and rubbish and unopened toys and all sorts of things, stuffed toys, electronic goods, and it was a cluttered mess except for one room. And that one room was totally clear except for two chairs and a table. And on that table were like military and strategy magazines, you know, like military, how to conduct military operations. And that room was totally clear except for the chair and the tables and the magazines. And my question was, who was the other chair for?
Mm.
So whether you can suggest there was an indication that he was talking to somebody about strategy training, whether he was trained, is another thing altogether. It's hearsay. You can't prove it, but the room is quite strange. And the fact that he went to Hereford was quite strange and rose a red flag back here with Interpol.
Yeah, so many things, Paul, that just, you know, like you said, there's just question after question. There's so many things that just don't add up, you know, with regards to the whole event. There's so many things in the lead up to it where there's a lot of questions and things that stand out that you think are out of the ordinary or even the extraordinary.
This is kind of strange.
It really
just
is.
Just going back to shooting again,
Sure.
The other thing to remember is a lot of the other victims were either also stationary in vehicles, though he shot four people at the toll booth, were approaching. A lot of people thought it was a reenactment, so they were approaching the cafe. Also, when he murdered the Micax, he pulled up in the car and they approached the car. They thought he was offering help. So the reason the body count was so high was because people, they really didn't know what was going on, or they thought it was part of the reenactment, or they were crouched under tables. And Martin didn't spray and pray. Recordings of the shootings were just, there were intervals of roughly 1 to 2 seconds between shots, which means, you know, presumably he just fired, took his time, aimed, fired again, took his time, fired again.
Hmm. Yeah, and it sounds more calculated, like you said, taking his time, getting the shot, taking the shot, lining up the next shot, looking for the next victim.
If you're holding the gun at hip height, which he was reported to have been doing, then people sitting at a cafe table will be at head height.
Yeah, that is
so if you're, if the distance is 1 to 2 meters away, you're pretty much going to hit someone in the head.
Yeah. But before I throw to Ethan for another question, I just wanted to. I had a question come through from Andy. He's, like I said, he's in the pre-show chat. He's a colleague of ours who usually does a show with us, and he's enjoying a night at Uluru at the moment. And he's just asked me a question. Told me to ask you this question. He wants to know, was Martin Bryant a pre-programmed patsy set to go off using drugs and, you know, sort of MK Ultra mind controlled methods? Like, is that, does that something like that sort of sound like it could be true, or is, what are your thoughts on that? That's his question.
My thoughts are, I dug into this fairly deeply. So the first thing is, for all the people out there, they're going to go, oh my God, tinfoil nut conspiracy wackos. MK Ultra is real.
Yeah, absolutely it is.
An absolute factual endeavor undertaken initially by the OSS before they became the CIA. And if you want to dig a little deeper, one of the early recipients of MK Ultra, when it was called OSS, was a young man of 16 years old who was intelligent enough to join Cambridge, who later on went to become, he was a fellow called Ted Kaczynski, who later on became the Unabomber. He was definitely a recipient of MK Ultra. So MK Ultra was real. It was discovered. It was, it carried out illegal activities, use of psychotropic drugs, sexual abuse of children, violence, intimidation, psychological warfare, all sorts of programming on in some cases unwitting participants. It was shut down by Congress, supposedly, in the 60s when it discovered what they're up to. MK Ultra has a history in Australia. Definitely. If you want to research some interesting scandals, there was the Chelmford Hospital scandal where patients, including children, were experimented upon by doctors who were part of the Tavistock Institute. Tavistock was an institute of social, basically social programming or social studies. Deeply affiliated with in England with a lot of very well-known psychologists and psychiatrists, one of which was a fellow called Dr. Cunningham Dax. Dr. Cunningham Dax was in England. In 1969, he moved to Tasmania. He's on record as talking about basically undertaking programs of deep sleep hypnosis, and studying things like the effects of high-level traumas on compliance and on, you know, on society in general. When Martin Bryant was 14 years old, I believe, in 1984, he was sent to Dr. Cunningham Dax for assessment. So Dr. Cunningham Dax assessed him and basically, you know, told his parents that he had a low IQ, he was going to, you know, socially be inept. And his mother basically questioned whether or not he was schizophrenic, and Dr. Cunningham Dax said, oh, it's a bit more complicated than that. But I've read all the psych reports from, and they're all very nebulous. So just to clear a few facts up, Brian has never been diagnosed with anything more than an Asperger's type syndrome. Never been formally diagnosed as schizophrenic, though one of the reports the doctor strongly believed that he was, and he was taking medication for schizophrenia. And I researched the medication. It was basically saying, you should not take this medication if you don't have schizophrenia. Brian was taking that medication. Some of his mother and his, I believe his girlfriend believed he might have been schizophrenic. He, as far as I know, he's never also been formally diagnosed as being sociopathic or having dual personality. My research into Martin suggests that he was a lot smarter than people thought he was. One of the inmates that I spoke to in prison who spent time with Martin said, I asked him a question, said, do you think there was like, you know, different side to him? He said, yeah, there's like two Martin Bryants. One was just like a giggling kind of imbecile who, quote, we had to teach how to push a broom. The other guy was very cunning. Now, anyone who knows anything about sociopathy knows that sociopaths can be clever, manipulative, they can lie very well, they can hide, and they can be charming. You know, Mark's good-looking, blonde-haired. He certainly used a lot of his charm.
Like empathy, too.
MK Ultra, I believe there is a tenuous connection given that Dr. Cunningham Dax was part of Tavistock. He evaluated Martin. He also worked with people like Rawlings and Rees, who were doctors that were implicated in Chelmford. So there is, to me, there is certainly the possibility that he was used as an experiment, or at least he was the perfect candidate for it. Apparently, Dr. Dax moved to Tasmania because it was the perfect testing ground. There was a lot of isolated communities, violence, incest, and it presented a perfect environment to test some of the social engineering theories.
Interesting. You're painting a very good picture there, but we'll let people try and piece that one together for themselves and see where they take it. But Ethan, you have a question again for Paul?
Yeah, mate, I'll just jump in here just to switch the tone a little bit as we head towards, obviously, the back half of the episode here. Just wanted to talk more a little bit about your film, Paul, and just to get some thoughts on what it's actually going to be about, giving all of these inconsistencies that you found, which I encourage everyone that's listening to this, if you're not familiar, definitely go and look up some of these things. Paul has done an excellent job painting the picture of some of the major questions with the Port Arthur narrative, and all of these things are on document, on record, and you can go and find these things. And we encourage everyone to go out there and do your own research and see that there's more to the picture with this. And I'm interested, because you've got such an understanding of this, Paul, and obviously as a content creator myself, just to see what you're going to do with this film. I know off air you were mentioning about dramatizations and documentaries and whatnot. What is WASP going to be? Is it going to be a documentary taking into account some of these inconsistencies you found, mate, or is it going to be more of a movie with actors, or what take are you going to take with this? And then just expand a little bit on some of the processes you've had with this film, mate.
The first thing to remember is going to be two things. It's the mainstay of the film, WASP, will be a full feature-length drama, a proper movie, with a decent budget. It's going to basically, in essence, on the surface, explore, it'll be like a biopic of Martin Bryant from when he was young up to the massacre. Then the massacre will be depicted and the aftermath. It'll also simultaneously will be telling Stephen Howard's story. Stephen is a remarkably courageous man whose loss was profound. He lost his wife in the cafe, and he's a very angry man because of the way he was treated. And I want to tell Stephen's story as well. Mm-hmm. In doing that, there will be a dramatized feature, and on the surface it's going to basically present Martin Bryant as the perpetrator. However, there's going to be, I'm going to explore and depict all of what you would call the grassy knoll moments, all of the moments that we've talked about and more that can be factually proven, just some of the oddities, the coincidences, the circumstances that don't add up, the witness statements that suggest something else. Let's be very clear on this. There were 800 witness statements taken. Only two of them positively identified Martin Bryant. And both of those witnesses went on record, and I've read it, saying that they were influenced by all of the newspapers that printed Martin Bryant's photo the next day with titles like "This is the man" and "The killer." He hadn't even been charged. It's illegal to do that. They said they may have been influenced by that newspaper when they picked him out from the board. Conversely, there were people that knew Martin Bryant, that had grown up with Martin Bryant, who were there on the day, who said the shooter was not Martin Bryant. One of those was Jim Laycock. The other person was Graham Collier, who was shot in the throat. There were other people that knew Martin enough to know, saying it was not Martin Bryant. So the 800 witness statements were all over the shop. They described different lengths of hair, different ages, pockmarked skin. You know, Martin had flawless skin. So basically the witness statements, a lot of people saw a guy with blonde hair and a coat.
Mm. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've heard that too. My good friend Lindsay has made video on that.
You're going to, portray the shooter, but I'm not going to give it away, but all I'll say is I'm going to be creating enough doubt there for you to go, well, that could be anybody. And also, what I want to do as an artist, most of my art is geared towards the notion of, it's the Latin forma veritas atrocitas, beauty, truth, horror. I believe very much that everyone has to undertake a journey of darkness and horror to understand the truth about themselves and life, and then to appreciate beauty. This film is going to be madness on the screen. It's not going to be like a movie that you can sit there and put in a comfortable little box. It's going to be a punch in the face. I like to grab my audiences by the back of their neck and shove their face up against a mirror. It will be a mad and very confronting affair.
I like that.
You've gripped me already.
I like that. And I like the fact too, Paul, that you're talking about making it somewhat of a multi-dimensional film where you can watch it on the surface level, as a lot of people might, and just see, as you've said, the official story play out before their eyes. Or you can watch it on another level where you'll see different things happening, different lengths of hair, some of these grassy knoll moments that you're talking about. And I think it's fascinating that you're gonna blend the two of these together to really create that piece that really explains what's going on, with the story from that. I'm a big fan of that.
Absolutely. And look, it's one of the things when you look at all these events, everyone's trying to find some nice little neat packaged answer to everything. It's not the way it works. A lot of these events, even 9/11, they're just little moments of insanity. They don't make sense. Everything doesn't add up. This is a very strange case. The people involved were weird. Martin Bryan himself was weird. Helen Harvey was eccentric. Mm. It was a strange event. And I my plan as a director is to put madness up there and just take you on a journey that you will not come back from. I'm very good at it. I've done it before. So I've made feature-length films before, and I've done some very, very dark theatre shows, very psychological stuff. And conversely as well, as I said, I'll be doing a full documentary that's going to fully explore the alternate theories, including having a reenactment of the possible, the most likely outcome for if it was a setup, how it would have taken place. And I do want to say this just to all the people out there that say, oh, come on, just for gun control, they're not going to go out there and murder men, women, and children. In terms of the way I feel about our governments, anybody out there who thinks our governments don't get up to all kinds of nefarious acts, including murder, corruption,
pedophilia.
Yeah, you name it. Yep. You're deluding yourselves. They do. They have throughout history and in all countries of the world. But my belief is that gun control is not would not have been the required outcome. It's the oldest motivators in the book: money, power, and influence and control. And all of those things, including if you want to talk about 9/11, all of those things certainly came to the fore. Increased police powers, increased security, the ability to seize funds from overseas accounts,
removal of freedoms and rights.
Rights eroded for personal liberties and freedoms, and money. People can and do, and certainly in the case of Port Arthur, a lot of people benefited. You'd have to go into detail with that, but certainly Helen Harvey's fortune, which Martin inherited, basically confiscated, shall we say. Yeah. So money, power, and influence. John Howard stole the gun control stance from the Australian Labor Party. Liberals were always used to be pro-gun, but Labor was staunchly anti-gun. And I don't think Howard was I don't think he knew about what was going to happen, but I think he certainly was shrewd enough to exploit it. Though he did have anti-gun legislation drafted in 1993. So he already had the legislation drafted, but there was no way it was going to get through all the states. So after Port Arthur, he became our Teflon Prime Minister. You know, four terms the guy had, because he was smart. He just utilized every opportunity to make him seem like a strong and powerful leader. Yep, and he was.
Never let a crisis go to waste, eh?
Well, absolutely. And I think in making the decision to overturn state law with federal jurisdiction, which is unlawful and unconstitutional.
Unconstitutional, that's right.
He just basically railroaded over the top and went, no coronial inquest. And that means it put it to bed and shut it all down. And they locked Martin Bryant away. And all the people that for all these years have the answers, you know, they're not given the right of reply or questioning, or, you know, even the victims. The victims were never given the coronial inquest they required to find out about the locked fire exit door.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, that's injustice.
Wrong and sad on so many levels.
Paul,
you've got...
In terms of the repression of information too, this is the other thing I want to say. It's not North Korea. We're Australia. We're supposed to be the lucky country. We're supposed to be transparent and free in liberty. So you tell me why I can't go and visit Martin Bryant in prison, why I can't get access to the forensics evidence, why I'm making a film and I can't get answers to the facts that I need to make the film accurately. You know, I understand it's a particularly heinous and traumatic event, but it's a part of our history. It would be a black, and it doesn't give anyone the right to just repress that and say, well, no, we're not going to talk about it. You're not allowed to do this. You're not allowed to do that. You know,
well, the only conclusion out of that, Paul, is it's a dead set cover up, mate. That's the only conclusion you can make out of that.
Well, I just have to say, I'm questioning why, you know, the court seal was about to end in 7 years, and now bank, most of you will be dead before that evidence is supposedly able to be released. And the only person who has access to that is the Chief Commissioner of Police. I've already sent him an email. I got an application form sent back. I've spoken to someone. They said, look, at the commemorative, everybody contacted the Chief Commissioner and said, can we get access? And they're all denied.
Yeah. So one thing, you also mentioned pre-show was with regards to the digitization of documentation. Can you just reiterate on that point as well?
Yeah, basically, back in the day, there was all sorts of things on VHS, things recorded on audio cassette, different formats, different, and ostensibly the plan was to digitize all of that so it's preserved, but then it's all in one place and then it's put into the archive. But when I spoke to the person who conducted that endeavor, she told me that the archive will not even list what's in the archive. All it will say is the Port Arthur files or whatever. So you won't know what's in there, and 75 years from now, I very much doubt anyone else will get access to it either.
Unless you become that commissioner yourself. Maybe there's a goal for you.
To me, it's astounding that one man arbitrarily has that kind of power. I suppose you could go to a police minister and try and overturn that, but that's unlikely.
Yeah.
So here you are in your country of Australia, and, Jesus, Charles Manson and Ed Kemper were able to be interviewed by journalists and have their days in court. But here we are in Australia, and this man... Look, I'm going to say a couple of things too. I've spoken to enough people that have been with him in prison because that was the only way I could get some kind of information.
Mm-hmm.
They've all asked him. They asked, but why did you do it? Why did you do it? Martin Bryant, from what I've heard from a couple of different sources, admits involvement. He admits that he killed four people. He admits to killing the Martins in the cottage, and he admits to kidnapping Glenn Piers, shooting his girlfriend, and then later on killing Glenn. So, yeah, that's four people. Mm. But he said he didn't do Port Arthur. And when one of the inmates asked him who did, he said men in blue overalls and then got very frightened and wouldn't say any more. Now, that's hearsay. That was what was told to me by a person I've been in a lot of contact with in the prison. I also spoke to somebody who said I used to play chess with Martin, and he wasn't an easy beat. He could play chess. So you kind of suggest, well, is he 66 IQ? Is he dumb? Is he lying? Interestingly enough, the full transcript of the interview that was conducted with Martin Bryant by two police officers, when it was played in court, had 65 pages redacted. I managed to obtain the defense copy, which has none of the which has all of the pages there. When you read that one and compare it to the redacted version, Martin is a lot more on the ball. He's very much, I do not recall, I do not recall. No, I was never at Port Arthur. No, I don't know that firearm. He comes across a lot sharper. But, of course, 65 pages were redacted when it was read out in court. The other thing that Martin said in the unredacted interview was that he was tortured. He said, they pulled my arms up behind my head and they made me lie down on my burnt back. Now, if that had come out in court, try and tell me that some defense lawyer wouldn't say, listen, this was obtained, you know, any confession from Martin's obtained under torture. So these are the little things that the public don't know.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Now,
all of the files that I've got on Port Arthur, if you go to the Facebook site, which is WASP, the Port Arthur Massacre, there is a link there to a Dropbox account, and all the files are there, including the unredacted interview. So anyone can get this information, just go there and grab it.
Yep, you heard it from Paul himself there, folks. If you're interested, go and check it out. Paul, I'm going to have to jump in here, mate. We'll probably have to wrap this up shortly, but... Oh, mate, I can tell you now, Paul, you've, geez, mate, you could turn this into a 9-season, 24 episodes a season, you know, Netflix series about Port Arthur. There's so much to go over, and I fear the job you've got, the task ahead of you, mate, to put this all together, to even just to produce a feature film is going to be a phenomenal task, and congratulations to you for taking on board and doing it. Have you got a date set in mind of when, like a release date? Are you close to completion? At all?
Yeah, look, I couldn't have picked a harder movie to get off the ground, but it's gaining. So keep an eye out, everybody, because in about a month, there's going to be a full funding launch. There'll be a public crowdfunding campaign. There'll be a full business plan that will be released to business people, and also an online forum to attract investors directly. There'll be a trailer coming out as well. And get on board. I need your help. This is going to be your movie. This is the chance for you to have your say in it. I'm open to anyone who wants to contact me on the Facebook site and just ask questions or hassle me or call me a bullshit or whatever you want to do. I'll talk to anybody. I've had multiple death threats in relation to this endeavor. And I've also been officially warned off by ex-police, ex-military, and ex-government saying, leave it alone. So it's a hairy, hairy endeavor, but I will make this movie. But well, I do need your help.
Thank you so much for coming on board and talking to us today. It's awesome that you're taking this on board. And once you've got those details released, everyone out there, please make sure you follow Paul's work on Facebook. That's WASP, the Port Arthur Massacre. Look that one up. Like the page, follow it, and keep in touch with what he's doing. Paul, when anything more comes out, if you want us to help share the trailer around, please get in touch with us again and shoot us a link. We'll be happy to promote that one for you, and any funding pages and systems you've got in place, we'll be happy to throw those up as well to help get this off the ground for you, mate. Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks again, Paul Motor, everyone. And that is, he's the producer of the film. It's hopefully getting put together as quickly as possible. There's so much to do, but we hope he gets it underway. And that is WASP, the Port Arthur Massacre. Paul, once again, thanks for joining us on the General Knowledge Podcast. Ethan, thanks again for joining us as well.
Thanks, fellas.
Yeah, it was great to have everyone here for this one as well, except for Andy, who's enjoying his time out at Uluru. So thanks again, everyone, and good night.